We're going to get started. Welcome to this session about the role of the left in the struggle for LGBTI rights. My name is Louise and I'm from the Melbourne branch of Socialist Alternative. Roz here will be doing the talk. She's also from the Melbourne branch. Roz has been a part of Socialist Alternative for some years now, too many to count, and is also the convener of the Rainbow Network of LGBTI groups in states and private schools around Victoria. So Roz will kick it off and then we'll have time for discussion.
Okay, cool. So before I start, I just wanted to acknowledge LGBTI elders past and present. It's something I've come to do more frequently when I speak, and obviously this whole conference is acknowledges Indigenous elders past and present, but for me I think it's really important to acknowledge that there are many, many fighters and activists who've gone before who have paved the way to where we are today with the LGBTI struggle, and I want to pay my respects to those people. Okay, so Chris Tomlinson wrote at 5:36 a.m. on March the 13th this year, "Homosexual people are heterosexual people with an illness, IMO." That means, in my opinion. "We care for them as we would someone with a fever, sickness, or disease. But not by endorsing or agreeing with their actions. You would do the same for a drug addict." Another person, Steve Ellis, on the next day, March the 14th at 12:51 a.m. wrote, "Honestly, where are their brains at? Makes me sick that politicians and the gay lobby think that they can dictate to all of us, and especially how we raise our kids." And the final one that I picked out from a person called Lana Hadfield on the same day at 10:16 p.m. who said, "Girls be girls, boys be boys, and grow up real men and women. The rest is evil," capital letters. All of these comments were made on the Facebook page of Australian Christians in the same week that Peter Abetz, who's the brother of Eric Abetz, who's a former pastor and a current Liberal Member of Parliament in Western Australia, said that Safe Schools Coalition, a program aimed at supporting gender diversity and sexual diversity in schools, was, quote, "really not an anti-bullying program. In fact, when you look at it closer, it really is little more than a gay, lesbian, transgender lifestyle promotion program. The militant gay, lesbian lobby is trying to get this into our schools to normalize what they consider the LGBTI agenda." He said the problem with the program is that it actually seeks to celebrate homosexuality and that it was really a Trojan horse that pushes the views of the militant gay lesbian lobby to teens. The Victorian director of Family Voice Australia sent out a message to all of their members claiming that the Safe Schools Coalition program being rolled out by our state and federal government poses one of the greatest threats to children in our lifetime. Safe Schools normalizes homosexuality to teachers and vulnerable children. By encouraging students to come out as gay, lesbian, or transgender, the program exposes students to serious physical and psychological health risks. Encouraging confused boys to use girls' toilets and change rooms and vice versa is inappropriate and could lead to problems with sexual harassment. In 2010, so 5 years ago, I was the person who set up Safe Schools Coalition in Victoria, and I was doing that to try and do something about extraordinarily high levels of homophobia and transphobia in schools, to support teachers and schools to actively and positively include same-sex attracted, intersex, gender diverse and transgender students, staff and families. And since then, the program has been welcomed by hundreds of teachers and students across the state. The Australian Education Union has given its full backing, and the program has been backed by the new Labor government in Victoria. All of this is good news. Yet, it's 2015, and I am still spending considerable amounts of my time in that program debating the question of whether a high school student can take their same-sex partner to their school formal. There are two things wrong with this. which are quite obvious. One, why is it still considered controversial to have a partner of the same sex? And two, why do we still have school formals and debutante balls? Debutante balls are making a comeback in Victoria, let me tell you, where young women wear white dresses and are given away by a male partner, which has to be a male partner. These things are on the increase in this state in 2015. And I think the answer to this is because LGBTI oppression and heteronormativity are woven into the fabric of capitalism. The reality is that the amount of homophobia directed at young people in Australia and in Australian schools remains virtually unchanged in the last 15 years. Research shows that almost one in five same-sex attracted young people, almost one in five, will experience physical homophobic abuse between the ages of 14 and 21, being beaten up, punched, kicked, stories of people having their hair set on fire in playgrounds in this country today. Almost one in five same-sex attracted young people will have that experience today in Australia. And for transgender and gender diverse people, these experiences of discrimination and abuse are even worse. If you want to affirm a gender identity that doesn't align with the sex you're assigned at birth, if you want to do that in a medical way to change your body, you have to wait an extremely long time at best and pay an extremely high price of your own money. None of this is covered on any kind of Medicare program. The gender clinic at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, who basically looks after children who are transgender or gender diverse, their waiting lists, which I know from the person who works there, are now over a year long for the amount of referrals that they have. They've had more referrals in the past year to that gender clinic than they've had in the first 10 years of their operation combined. And these young people are not getting the support they need in the time that they need it. If you happen to be transgender and you live anywhere outside of a major city in Australia, you'd be lucky to find a single medical professional at all that has any knowledge or experience of what it means to be transgender. According to the first major study into the experiences of transgender and gender diverse young people in Australia, almost half of those young people have been diagnosed with depression, 38% had thought about suicide, and one in three did not have the support of their family. Yet, it's quite amazing that young people do continue to question the idea of binary gender in radical ways. In the research, in the same piece of research, over 40% identified their gender as something other than male or female, choosing terms like genderqueer, genderfluid, agender, androgynous to describe their current gender identity. And when they do that, they face multiple barriers everywhere they turn. Apart from social stigma and discrimination, almost every single structure in society is set up to accommodate only two possible genders, male or female. Everything from the toilets we use, the school uniforms, changing rooms, all official documents, passports, the processes that you go through at airports, everything is divided into these two limited gender options. But I think perhaps the best illustration of just how closely controlled our bodies, genders, and sexualities continue to be in 21st century capitalism is the treatment of intersex people. In an article published in Nature, the scientific journal, earlier this year, science journalist Claire Ainsworth wrote, "Biologists may have been building a more nuanced view of sex, but society has yet to catch up. When it comes to sex, there is still intense social pressure to conform to the binary model. This pressure has meant that people born with clear DSDs, so differences or disorders they call it of sex development, often undergo surgery to normalize their genitals. Such surgery is controversial because it is usually performed on babies who are too young to consent and risks aligning a sex at odds with the child's ultimate gender identity. Intersex advocacy groups have therefore argued that doctors and parents should at least wait until a child is old enough to communicate their gender identity or old enough to decide whether they want surgery at all. So this so-called corrective surgery is still performed on babies and children with intersex variations. And there were guidelines published, the first guidelines anywhere in Australia were published in 2013 by the Victorian government, and they continue to justify these procedures. And none of these procedures have anything to do with the actual physical health of a person. So none of these changes are made because there's some physical health thing that they have to address. They are all based on what they call psychosocial rationales, right? And these psychosocial rationales include marriage prospects, minimizing family concern and distress, and mitigating the risks of stigmatization and gender identity confusion. So one clinician organization, for example, recommends infant surgery to allow the child to develop without the psychosocial stigma or distress which is associated with having genitalia incongruous with the sex of rearing. Basically, what we're seeing is the medical profession, absolutely backed by the state, performing unnecessary surgeries on babies and infants to sculpt their genitals in a way, in a shape that fits heterosexual marriage or heterosexual relationships and allows for the prospect of marriage. That is the rationale in 2015 for these surgeries. So this push to fit people into these physical and social gender constructs that promote heterosexuality is still incredibly strong and reinforced through the judicial system, through the medical, all of medicine, the media, and all social institutions. So there's no denying that some areas of life have improved for LGBTI people, and programs like Safe Schools Coalition are making some difference, but we're still an extremely long way from liberation, or anything even resembling liberation. So the question I guess I'm asking is, what role can and does the left play in this struggle from where we are now to what we might consider something like liberation? And what I want to argue is that only Marxism provides both the theory and the practice of genuine human liberation. So what I'm not going to talk about is the practical role of the left historically. And I think the left historically and practically has been the key driver in the struggles for LGBTI rights. But I'm not going to just go through a list of all of those historical points. And I'm not going to go through a list of the particular achievements of individual Marxists or socialists who have done pretty remarkable things as part of these struggles. I think people should read Liz Ross's book if they want that kind of chronology of the left's involvement in LGBTI movements. Instead, what I want to argue is that Marxism offers both the hope and the strategy needed to create a world where human sexuality, gender, and how we relate to our bodies can blossom in extraordinarily new and amazing ways that we can only try to imagine today. Because Marxism is a theory of social change. And before I explain what that means, I think it's important to clarify that when I say Marxism, I'm not talking about Stalinism. I don't subscribe to some form of identity politics where just because you say you're a socialist state, it means that you are one. And that's something that's probably been debated in other sessions, so I don't need to say too much about it. But I think it's important to mention because historically, one of the apparent contradictions of the left and some of the things that the left has done really terribly in terms of LGBTI struggles, I think a lot of those contradictions are based on the connections that those organizations or those individuals have had and their relationship to and defense of Stalinist politics. And I think that goes for a lot of the Communist Party of Australia's mistakes and contradictions around sexuality come back to that question of what did you say about Stalinism and the Soviet Union and the counter-revolution in Russia. So I think that's important just to put that out there. So the actual, the real Marxist tradition begins with what Marx and Engels actually wrote, what they actually said and did about questions of gender and sexuality, and I think importantly, all questions of human liberation. So the most common starting point for what Marx and Engels wrote is actually in the conclusions that they came to, which is where most people start, and in Engels' work, The Origins of Private Property, the Family and the State, where he famously surmises, and I quote, "What we can now conjecture about the way in which social relations will be ordered after the impending overthrow of capitalist production is mainly of a negative character, limited for the most part to what will disappear. But what will there be new? That will be answered when a new generation grow up. They will care precious little what anybody today thinks they ought to do. They will make their own practice and their corresponding public opinion about the practice of each individual, and that will be the end of it." In order to come to this conclusion on sexual liberation, Marx and Engels had developed both an understanding of capitalism and why and how it would take the overthrow of capitalist production to completely reorder and reshape sexual relations and gender relations. I think if we use this same methodological key, we can unlock the door to LGBTI liberation. Came up with that myself. That's pretty good, isn't it? You have to say yes. Okay, so what did Marx, you know, what is this methodological key? And I think that's historical materialism, which Marx outlines in part in the German Ideology in 1845. And I'm going to quote from some of what he wrote to help us understand that. So Marx says, the first premise of all human history is, of course, the existence of living human individuals. Thus, the first fact that can be established is the physical organization of these individuals and their consequent relation to the rest of nature. People can be distinguished from animals by consciousness, by religion, or anything else you like. They themselves begin to distinguish themselves from animals as soon as they begin to produce their means of subsistence, a step which is conditioned by their physical organization. By producing their means of subsistence, people are indirectly producing their actual material of life. He goes on in a later passage. This method of approach is not devoid of premises. It starts out from the real premises and does not abandon them for a moment. Its premises are people, not in any fantastic isolation and rigidity, but in their actual empirically perceptible process of development under definite conditions. As soon as this active life process is described, history ceases to be a collection of dead facts, as it is with the empiricists, themselves still abstract, or an imagined activity of imagined subjects, as with the idealists. And I think what we can draw from this is that sexuality isn't simply a social construct, but that humans construct society in direct relation to the way that both production and reproduction are organized. We are all simultaneously both products of the world and world producing. This method means that Marxists can develop understandings of sexual liberation and gender liberation as people themselves develop new identities and expressions of their own experiences. So Marx did not need to directly write about things like transgender liberation or intersex rights in order to contribute to our understanding of these questions today. Because Marxism provides us with a series of ideas and theory that is central to the struggle for LGBTI liberation. I'm going to go through what those are. So firstly, the knowledge that human society has not always been organized into hierarchical structures. So class divisions are not eternal or natural or deemed, you know, given by God or anybody else. In fact, the vast majority of human history lived without class. Those people that lived, or in some cases still live today, without class division or hierarchical divisions according to class, had radically different ideas about behaviours and identities to do with sexuality and gender. For example, communities that include today still people with more than two genders, where same-sex relationships are an expected part of normal life, where intersex variations were celebrated or in some cases even worshipped. So the language LGBTI reflects a very particular time and place. And the evidence shows us that people, of course, are not born homophobic or transphobic, or are somehow naturally, you know, shaped to resist LGBTI lives. This resistance, homophobia or transphobia as we know it today, and the structural oppression of women and LGBTI people occurred with this division of society into hierarchical classes. Because at this point in history, there were material reasons for the new ruling classes to take actions to propagate ideas that oppress women and sexual minorities. Those ideas about what was considered normal sexual behaviour and which characteristics are supposed to fit which genders and so on. In particular, these ideas were solidified and clarified through the imposition of the construct of the nuclear family during the infancy of capitalist production. So it's not a matter of historical chance that the invention of the category homosexual was created for a type of person rather than particular behaviours in the late 19th century. This was the time when capitalism was deepening its roots across Europe and understanding the need for family units to reproduce and look after the growing working class. To smooth the operation of capitalism, the ruling class has benefited and continues to benefit from oppressing our bodies, relationships, sexuality and gender identities. Alongside sexism, homophobia and transphobia, both serve to break the spirits of ordinary people, to consume our thoughts, to make us accept the status quo, and for us to keep living or aspiring to live or feel like we should live in small social units and families where we must reproduce and take responsibility for those people in those units. So all of this, you know, life under capitalism and what capitalism does to us seems a bit bleak. At this point you think, well, if I could just take my same-sex partner to the formal, that would be okay and I'd be, you know, maybe I'll have a good time. But Marx and Engels did not end their work there with understanding capitalism. What they wanted to do and what they found was that the features and structures of capitalism are inherently contradictory. And I mean contradictory not in a way that, like, the government funds Safe Schools Coalition and then doesn't legislate for marriage equality. That seems contradictory. Not that kind of contradiction. The kind of contradictions Marx and Engels were talking about are contradictions that hold within them the potential for the liberation of all humanity and for revolutionary change. So workers, the working class, have both the power and the interests as a unified class to run the world differently. All forms of oppression work against this interest. We can also see one of the contradictions that's most clear is that crisis is inherent to capitalism. So economic crisis, like the one we're seeing around the world today, cannot be avoided. There's also the never-ending cycle of war that breaks that begins to provide cracks to the system that seems like such a monolith. So these crises and the power of workers to stop production and reorder it to meet our needs and not to make profits contain the potential for a different kind of society. So I think if we want to see an end to homophobia and transphobia, not just a small or temporary reduction, we have to do more than try to reform the system or educate people to try and be better. And Marxism has an answer for this too. How do we learn to not be homophobic? How does that process happen where our ideas change? Because being a revolutionary theory, that process of changing the world, the whole system, through mass revolutionary united action, in that process itself, ideas about homophobia and transphobia will have to be challenged, and people's entire perspectives on the world will change. So LGBTI liberation is bound together with the liberation of the whole of society, and the basis for that liberation is class struggle. Of course, it goes without saying, but I'm going to say it, that LGBTI people are not some separate category from the working class. I think sometimes people can think about it in those ways. We intersect, if you like. LGBTI people are part of all classes, all cultures, all religions, all backgrounds, all around the world. Okay, so I want to finish by going through a few examples that show how this theory works in practice when put to the test. And so I think we can gain some really essential insight through looking at Russia after the 1917 revolution. So it's nearly 100 years ago, but the advances that they made, even in the area of legal reform, I think make most 21st century small-L liberal governments, you know, it puts them to shame. So there's an extremely detailed and well-researched book, I don't know if people have read it, called Homosexual Desire in Revolutionary Russia by a historian called Dan Healy. And he's no Marxist. But what he found is that the Bolsheviks, and he, you know, he's done a lot of research and he's not a Marxist, and so that's really useful to know, that he concluded that the Bolsheviks made an explicit decision to remove homosexual acts from the criminal code that was being rewritten, as you know, from 1917 and through that revolutionary period. At that same time in 1917, if you were living in Britain and you were convicted of the crime of buggery, you would have been sentenced to life imprisonment. And in Australia, the full decriminalisation of homosexual acts, which is what we're talking about here, did not occur until 1997 in Tasmania. That's a full 80 years after the Russian Revolution. The new legal code in Russia after the revolution also introduced gender-neutral language. Now, this is something that transgender advocates today often, you know, is a key demand of the transgender and other advocacy movements. They also removed the fixed age of consent to allow for judgment to be made around sexual maturity, and this, of course, applied equally for same-sex relationships. So in the context of the early 1920s, what I think the Russian example shows us is actually more about the approach of socialism, of what happens, rather than the specifics of the outcomes, although I think those outcomes are pretty amazing. So the Bolsheviks were pretty busy at this time, as you can imagine, defending the gains of the revolution from all of the forces that wanted to stop it, both within Russia and from forces outside of Russia. But even in the midst of this, their approach to reforms around sexuality were based on removing the constraints of bourgeois thought. So the prejudices of the ruling class, in largely in Russia, that was the religious prejudices of the ruling class, and trying to make decisions that were based on science and evidence, on medicine rather than morality. And given that there was no pressure on the Bolsheviks from LGBTI organisations or even individual gay activists, those, you know, the arguments of people who say we need people only of LGBTI identities to be making these arguments obviously begin to unravel, because that wasn't the case in Russia during the Russian Revolution. In addition to these legal reforms, the Bolsheviks also took part in international advocacy for sexual reform. So delegations attended conferences of the World League for Sexual Reforms in 1921. The Soviet Health Commissar Semashko visited Hirschfeld's Scientific Humanitarian Institute in 1921, and Hirschfeld was welcomed to the US Russia in the 1920s. So they were doing more than just making legal reforms. They were actually looking at ways internationally to show solidarity with people who were working towards some kind of broader reforms for, gay, lesbian, or whatever language was being used at the time, homosexual people, I suppose. But even short of this kind of revolutionary upheaval, I think the history of capitalism, even in the 20th century and even in the 21st century, shows that key victories in the struggles for LGBTI rights have been won during or after periods of heightened class struggle. And that our losses, when things go backwards for LGBTI people, have happened when there have been defeats in the class struggle. So even with the formation of the gay liberation movement in the US, in the UK, and later here in Australia, that didn't come out of nowhere. That came as part of a broader radicalisation of society that included workers engaging in industrial struggles, the mass engagement of ordinary people in opposition to the Vietnam War. And I think actually, you know, the kind of politics that were at the core of the gay liberation movement were explicitly revolutionary politics. So Dennis Altman at the time, who's since, I think, gone much further to the right in his politics and was formerly a colleague of mine at La Trobe University, but back in the day he was pretty radical, and he wrote from his observations of gay liberation both in the US and Australia that gay liberation sees with Marx that the liberation of each depends on the liberation of all, for the homosexual cannot win liberation without a general sexual liberation. In Tribune, the newspaper of the Communist Party of Australia, Dennis Freeney, an openly gay party leader of the Communist Party, published an article called Gay Liberation 5 months before any gay liberation groups actually met in Australia. And these early activist struggles in Australia for LGBT rights were taking place in the context, in the aftermath of the general strike of 1969, again the anti-war movement, the student movement growing in Australia, women's liberation movement and Aboriginal struggles, and so on. The recent movie Pride, which hopefully people have seen, I saw it twice, cried most of the time, both times, was a wonderful movie because I think it illustrated so well the idea of solidarity that sits at the heart of socialist politics. So the gay and lesbian activists at the time recognised that they shared the same interests as the miners in fighting back against the right-wing government of Margaret Thatcher. And I think what they recognised in Lesbian and Gay Support the Miners was that the result of the miners' strike and the battle in that part of the class war, which was the core of the class war at that time, against the anti-union Tory government, was the key struggle for LGBTI rights, just as much as it was about miners' rights. And so when these two groups worked together, they both grew in strength. And so the same logic applies in reverse, where in the aftermath of the miners' strike and the tragedy of the loss, really, of that period of time, in 1988 in the UK, and it's something that I was acutely aware of at the time, growing up in schools in the UK, there was a section of the Local Government Act that was introduced called Section 28, which is something that people in the UK, I campaigned a lot around the removal of Section 28, which came in after the defeat of the miners' strike. And it meant that schools were banned from, this was in that section of the law, schools were banned from promoting or teaching the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. So that was a Thatcher law that came in after she'd beaten the miners. So you can see that link between class victories and LGBTI victories, and the same with defeats. I think even in Australia, when Howard was in the middle of the trying to get work choices to happen in 2004 as a deliberate act in the class war, that was when he introduced the Homophobic Marriage Act that we continue to oppose and fight back against today. So to sum up, when Rodney Croom argued in October last year that marriage equality is needed to strengthen the fight against ISIS, we reached a new low, I think, in the struggle for LGBTI rights. I'll just remind you what he wrote. There's no better time to affirm our core liberal democratic values by providing equality for all than when we are facing a thuggish and deeply homophobic death cult. He may as well be Tony Abbott, who said death cult 7 times in 2 minutes. People saw that news. That's like Rodney Croom is saying the exact same thing as Tony Abbott. And he is still considered one of the leaders of the LGBTI movement in Australia today. So believe me, we have reached a pretty low point. And actually, the debate in the marriage equality movement that Louise is all too familiar with in the last year, really, has been one about whether we should actually have mass rallies or not. That's the debate in the marriage equality movement. And I think that's an indictment of the right of the campaign who are arguing that we shouldn't, and there are people who are arguing that we shouldn't, but I think it also shows us just how far class struggle politics have gone backwards since those highs of the 60s and 70s and the gay liberation movement. Because we are living through historically low levels of industrial struggle and militant political activity. And this unfortunate reality, I think, does not change the fact that it will only be through a revitalised class struggle and revolutionary change that we can hope for the liberation of LGBTI people. So the ruling class may concede reforms, and they have, because we fought for them, and they may fund programs like Safe Schools Coalition, but they will never transform capitalism to create real economic or social justice. And it's only the working class that shares the interests of all oppressed groups in society, because we can only meet the needs of everybody by taking collective ownership of everything. So anyone on the left who has at the core of their politics the aim of working class self-emancipation will always side with the oppressed. And this is not because it's a moral question. This is not a question of being better educated than other people. This is not because we have progressive values or a deep understanding of intersectionality or privilege. It is about going back to the starting point of Marx and Engels' materialist method and recognizing that the revolutionary power of a united working class can change the fundamental basis of society to achieve true democracy, freedom, and liberation. And I'll say that organisations like Socialist Alternative, which I'm proud to be a member of, can and do play a really important role in fighting for LGBTI rights today. I think putting the homophobic and transphobic marriage law firmly on the agenda in Australian politics has been a victory. But what we can achieve today should not be used as a barometer of what is possible in the future or even now. Our project, and something we need as many people as we can to contribute to, is rebuilding our side of the class struggle. It is the contours of this struggle for working class self-emancipation that will ultimately shape the struggle for LGBTI rights and holds the key to genuine liberation for every one of us in the future. Thank you.